Okay, welcome, good evening. Welcome to the Environment and Natural Resources and Agriculture Committee that we have reduced outreach here in the committee this year. Chairman Osmond and I have been, and the members have been working on some outreach to get out and talk about the Clean Water Legacy Bill, which I believe is House File 826. And tonight, before we get started, we'll introduce the members here of the committee, the House Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, and Agriculture. We'll start down on the south end of the of the table, and because we're very close to Representative Services District and probably in the famous Representative Rippolina's district. So we'll pass it down. Representative Rippolina will give a welcome. And recommended service as well.
Let's inform the Senator from Chisholm, I'm not on the committee, but I'm grateful to the and Vice Chair Gould for the invitation to be here, and I'm glad that you came up here on the committee. I'm Tom Rippolina, and I want to welcome the committee to my district. I asked Chair Osmond if I could chair the meeting, but he told me that no was already going to do it, so we're going to take care of that later on as the meeting. I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad to see all the members united to the mayor's game. I think Mr. Chair are very concerned about a lot of resources for one reason or another.
I'm Representative Aaron Peterson from the southwest part of the state, and yes, in terms of the water, and that's for the Minnesota River Basin, part of the River Basin, and Blue License River Basin.
I'm Nancy Jenner from District 18, so I'm up in the northwest part of the state with the Red River of the North.
My legislative district is both Mount Apple Valley down just south of Twin Cities, and I'm a chair of this
And David Hill, I represent District 6A, which is everything to the east of Representative Rippolina. And the reason Representative Osmond asked me to chair is that for every vote that you cast for me, you get more by the pound. So it's a good thing. I know you appreciate that.
I'm Steve, Representative Tom Hackbarth. I represent north of the Twin Cities, North County, Northern Oak County, and part of Shelburne County, City of Elkhart.
I'm State Representative Al Junkie from Wilbur, Minnesota, representing Kim Yopine County, and I just want to say thank you for inviting us to your community, and thank you up here. I know it's all your responsibility to have to represent Rippolina. In the Twin Cities, it's my responsibility. I have a movement. So you're the short straw, literally and figuratively.
I'm Helen Beck from the Enterprise and Health Research Department, legislative analyst assigned to the
The most important people in the military, the two people that do all the work on this committee.
And now I'm representing the administrative part of the committee.
Okay, and then also in the room tonight, we've got two county commissioners, County Commissioner Fink. Would you stand up, please? I imagine everyone knows County Commissioner Dennis Fink. And then the County Board Chair, Commissioner Nelson. You stand up? Very good, Chief Nelson. And then also in the room tonight, we have DNR personnel here to be a technical assistance to the DNR there. We have, and we have MPCA. So could the MPCA people please stand up? Ann Foss, Nelson French, and some other. Holy hell, we have a lot. Thank you. Well, everything we need to know will be here for MPCA tonight. Well, one of the things that we've been doing across the state is have been out meeting with people just like you folks to bring your ideas and comments for this group to listen to regarding this legislation or proposed legislation, and also to give explanations to questions that you may have. So the order of the evening will be first this. Chairman Osmond is the author of the bill, the chief author of the bill, and has been doing the the lion's share of the loan carrying on this bill since its inception. And so we'll hear from Chairman Osmond about the bill and have some explanation. And then we have an individual here, Craig Johnson. Okay, if you, with Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities, who will be giving a quite a bit of historical perspective and technical background of the purpose of the bill, reason for the bill, and then we'll have public comment and also questions. And if it works out, we'll have an interactive discussion regarding some of your questions and some of your points. So right now, I'd like to again ask Chair Mahathir to introduce this bill.
I want the feedback because this is off. I want to thank you for being here very much and giving us the opportunity to explain this bill. What we're doing is, in House File 826, a little bit different than many pieces of legislation. This particular piece of legislation does not create new laws or new mandates, new regulations. It does not develop new bureaucracy. What it really is trying to establish a process on how we can come into compliance with federal law with regard to our clean waters. And when you have federal law that's kind of putting a lot of mandates and identifying problems at the grassroots level, we think that we need to be able to channel dollars down to those grassroots level and have the state get coordinated so it can really have it's the biggest bang for the buck in trying to deal with these issues and to provide the most assistance possible. And so that's really what this bill is about, is trying to develop that process. And it was put together by a group of a wide variety of individuals that were representing organizations from all across the state of Minnesota. And I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Johnson and have him introduce himself as well as all the people that were involved in this. And why don't you take, I don't know if this has been working or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm government relations staff with the League of Minnesota Cities. And my pleasure to come up here today to give a little bit of background on the Federal Clean Water Act that is driving the need for this legislation and kind of where Minnesota is at and why we're at a point where this legislation has become important. In particular, obviously, representing the League of Minnesota Cities, the 854 cities we have in this state, I came into working on this 2.5 years ago based on city concerns about what the Clean Water Act restrictions were doing and threatened to do to cities' ability to develop and grow and to regulations that were being placed on cities to manage their wastewater and stormwater. Our cities work very hard and have spent billions of dollars as have our businesses in our cities, to protect water quality. And yet we're finding out, as some of these waters are tested, that it hasn't turned out to be enough, that water is actually coming back not meeting water quality standards in some cases. So we have the concern of getting our water quality to where it meets water quality standards. But secondly, it's impossible for a city to do good planning and growth and economic development planning when we don't know what kind of restrictions are going to be placed on us in the immediate future. When we don't know, for instance, whether additional pollution control is going to be required in just a couple of years, or whether a new development that we put extensive infrastructure work into will suddenly be determined to not be compatible as a land use. And then finally, we need to prevent constant change from happening on our regulations. If we don't address these problems quickly, we're going to see a piecemeal approach to this where every few years, every different part of the state is going to suddenly find itself with new regulations, and it won't be the same anywhere. So, with that, a little background on the Clean Water Act. We'll see how the static is going here. The Clean Water Act has not been substantially changed. This one's not on at all.
Yeah.
don't you?
I'm not going to say a word to it. Say,
I'm sorry. I'm not going to touch anything.
There. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Clean Water Act was passed in 1972 and contains a number of requirements that have been in place since that time. And none of these are new, none of them have been substantially changed. What it required states to do was take care of their water. And it put most of the burden on that on states as long as they were willing to run the programs. Minnesota is one that asked that they be able to run their own water protection programs, not have the federal government do it to us or for us. And so the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in Minnesota is the one that has been given responsibility by the federal government to do that. What the requirements included was going through all of the lakes, all of the rivers, all of the streams in the state, and determining what their designated use would be. That was done by 1974. Most of Minnesota was classified as warm water fisheries, which is just kind of a default classification, meaning you're supposed to be able to eat the fish out of the water, you're supposed to be able to swim in it without being sick. We do have some areas that were classified as outstanding resource value waters or designated trout lakes, things of that nature, especially up in this part of the state. But overall, most of the water in the state is warm water fishery. Once that's done, the state is supposed to assess the quality of all the water in the state to determine whether it is meeting water quality standards to be used for those purposes. And we actually haven't gotten very far in that. Right now, we have, with recently updated numbers, we've assessed 16% of the state's lakes and about 10% of the river and stream miles in the state. We're kind of adding about 2% a year to each of those numbers right now, which is a slow pace, but that's what we're able to do with the resources we have. What that means is we're well behind that requirement of the Clean Water Act already, but we're continuing to make slow progress on it. The result of that assessment is if the water meets water quality standards, that's fine, and we've got documentation to show that. If it does not, the water is required to be listed on a federal list of impaired waters. And once a water has been found to be not meeting water quality standards and is on that list, it kicks in a whole bunch of regulations under federal law that primarily restrict our ability to do any kind of activity on that water that would further the pollution effects on that water until we have a plan for how we're going to clean it up. The acronym that comes up constantly with this program is TMDL, and that's the plan to clean up the water. It stands for Total Maximum Daily Load, and it's a series of things, but one of the parts of it is a calculation of how much of a pollutant can the water handle before it's too polluted. These are only done in cases where a water has been found to be polluted, and only for the pollutant that was found to be a problem. So we don't do one of these big studies for every pollutant in every water of the state. We only do it if we find a water to have a problem. We try and figure out why it's having a problem, who's contributing, and what the state has to do to fix it. Once we've got that plan put together, that's called a TMDL, the State Pollution Control Agency pulls the details of it together, has to approve it, and then forward it to federal EPA for their review and approval. And once that's approved, the state can then start implementing that TMDL, and they can then have some ability to see some permitting and economic development happen again in those areas. I'm going to get to that more a little bit later when I discuss the current court issues that we have in Minnesota. Issue came to a head in Minnesota. We knew it was coming to a head in Minnesota several years ago. And in fact, it was in June of 2004 that a water conference was held in St. Cloud where Governor Pawlenty actually challenged and instructed the agencies to pull stakeholder groups together to try and figure out what we were going to do about this before a flood of citizen lawsuits started freezing development in the state. One of the unique things about the Clean Water Act is that it allows any citizen of the United States to sue any state or the federal government for failing to adequately protect water under the requirements of the Clean Water Act. And a number of states have seen very drastic judgments made against them in cases where they've been found to be outside the constraints of that federal law. We pulled a group together, and the group was as broad-based as we could grab. We had two city organizations that took part in the work on it. The Association of Counties took part. We had the Farm Bureau and the Farmers Union. We had the Watershed Districts and the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. We had two environmental groups, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and Clean Water Action. We had the Minnesota Lakes Association. And then we had a representative from Minnesota Power and from the Chamber of Commerce. And that group sat down and worked for about a year and a half to pull together the legislation that started off the legislative session last year, and put together a plan for how we were going to get the water cleaned up in a way that also allowed us to have economic growth in the state. The focus that the business interests that were at the table and the agricultural interests that were at the table came in with was trying to make sure that when these studies are done on the water, they're done with the best possible science. That we don't just do a quick guess as to who's causing the problem and assign the blame, but that we make sure that if a water stretch is found to have a problem, if a stream or a lake is found to have a problem, that we actually take the time to figure out why and what can be done about it, not just take a shotgun approach and hope the same solution works in every polluted water in the state. Second thing that we work very hard to assure is that these plans for how we're going to clean water up are developed on a local level, not worked out at the agency's office in St. Paul and then brought out for a final showing at the local level before they're trotted back. So that actually was a matter of putting together a process of how the public would get involved, what types of hearings would have to occur, and what types of feedback the agency would have to take as they developed their plan. And then finally, we pushed very hard for efficiency. As of the new listing that the Pollution Control Agency has out right now to add some more waters onto this impaired list, have well over 2,000 water bodies in Minnesota that have been found to be impaired. Over 700 of those for mercury-related impairments, which are being dealt with separately. The rest for more traditional impairments, typically. So nutrient levels, sediment problems, turbidity, water clarity problems, ammonia levels, and fecal coliform from either animal or human waste runoff. Those, obviously, if we did them one at a time, would take a really long time because these studies are thorough. They take more than a couple of years each to do, and several staff and a lot of money. So what we are pushing very hard for in this legislation is to consolidate those, make it so that when we look at problems in a particular water body, we look at all of the problems. So, for instance, right now in Lake Pepin, it's impaired for two significant problems, turbidity and nutrient load. Rather than doing two separate, 5 to 8 year studies on this huge chunk of water and then coming out with new plans for improvement at the end of each, we're looking at them both at the same time so that as my cities that are within that area have to decide what they're going to do, they know the whole picture at once. They don't get surprised with new regulation after new regulation. The process and the group whose acronym most of you have heard, the audience may not have heard quite as often except for the few that hang around the Capitol like I do, is the G16. Also included representatives of the four state agencies that deal with water regulation. So the Pollution Control Agency, Department of Natural Resources, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And so together we put forward this proposal that most notably, I think folks will recall from last year, started out with a funding proposal that was universally unacceptable. It was called the flush tax, the toilet tax. It was a water fee that would be collected from both septic tanks and municipal water hookups, sewage hookups, to help pay the costs of this program. That is not part of the current discussion, and Representative Osmond will get to that more a little bit later. The city needs on this really come down to two significant areas. One is we need to get these PMBLs done. We need to know where the water is polluted, what the problem is, and how it needs to be fixed, because we need to start figuring out how we're going to be able to afford doing it. We, in cities, are carrying most of the permits in the state. Most of the water discharge permits in Minnesota are city wastewater and now city stormwater discharges. There are a number of businesses that are big enough that they have their own wastewater or sited in a place where they need their own wastewater treatment or wastewater discharge of some sort. And they also have joined us in that concern that we need to know what regulations we're going to be expected to meet. The second thing we are going to need is assistance in the infrastructure needed to do it. This is a statewide problem. We're going to continue to find spots around the state where a new water problem shows up, and the people who are expected to take action in those areas, whether it's a private landowner doing a change in their farming practices or whether it's a city that has to put in phosphorus treatment on their wastewater plant, should expect that the state recognize that this is an additional responsibility and that the state has some resources there to help them both technically and financially to meet those requirements. The situation got a whole lot less hypothetical this last August, and a couple of you that have been at an earlier hearing have heard this update already, but the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy had filed a case that we mentioned in our testimony last session during the legislative process as something we had concerns about how it would turn out. The cities of Annandale and Maple Lake, which are in central Minnesota, right there, had filed to build a new joint wastewater facility. It's two small communities. One is about 1,800, the other is about 2,000, that are each growing very rapidly. They're part of the growth belt, kind of in the I-94 corridor on the way to St. Cloud. And they're slightly off, it's just south of it, but it's a very fast-growing area in Wright County. And they had seen that growth as something that they would not be able to handle with their existing wastewater. Annandale had a small two-lagoon system. Maple Lake had a small mechanical system that discharged, but to a wetland that couldn't handle a larger discharge. So the two of them combined to build a new wastewater plant. And that permit was issued by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, but was challenged by this environmental organization as being a violation of the Clean Water Act. And the reason is that it goes back to when I talked about when a water gets listed as impaired, it triggers new regulations. Once a water is found to be impaired, there can be no new or expanded source of pollution permitted that would cause or contribute further to that impairment, unless that new discharge source is within the scope of a completed and approved TMDL. So what that means is when Lake Pepin, in this case, on the Mississippi River in southeastern Minnesota, was found to have a nutrient load problem, the entire, if you look at the maps over here, the entire tan region of the state, over 50% of the geography of the state and 75% of the population, was informed that no new or expanded discharges of nutrients would be no permit could be issued for those. Came into question in this court case. The Pollution Control Agency had issued a permit because a city further down the river, Litchfield, was also building a new wastewater facility that was going to dramatically decrease phosphorus load in the river. So even though the new Annandale Maple Lake one would add a couple thousand pounds a year of phosphorus, the Litchfield plant would reduce over 50,000 pounds a year of phosphorus, and that's in the same river. So they had presumed that they would be able to say that that was a net benefit to the water quality and that they could go ahead and issue the permit. The state appellate court did not agree with it and actually pulled back the permit, rescinded the permit, and that question is now in front of the state Supreme Court. They did agree to hear the case, both the Pollution Control Agency and the cities of Annandale and Maple Lake requested that appeal. It has not been heard yet. We don't know how it will turn out, but we do know that the Clean Water Act will cause another similar lawsuit regardless of how this one turns out, because it is very clear that once an impairment is known, there can be no new discharge permitted. So even if in this case something is found to be an exception to that rule, the language is pretty clear in the federal law. The maps that we have over here show what kind of impact this can have. Lake Pepin is probably the biggest example we could have in the state, and it, as you can see, covers most of the state. Most PMDLs are significantly smaller than that, and you can see some of the ones outside the Lake Pepin area are smaller little balloon shapes. There would be a lot of those underneath that shaded area if it wasn't there too. There are smaller areas of impairment in there. But for the purposes of this map, it's just to show that that area is affected. And one thing that this committee spent some time doing in earlier hearings that Representative Osmond held in Le Sueur and in Annandale was to compare what is permissible in the area that's hatched in the Minnesota River from the rest of that tan area. And this is exactly why cities were especially concerned about this legislation. In the hatched area that Nelson is pointing to, the TMDL has already been completed for phosphorus problems. It's the lower Minnesota River. It has a dissolved oxygen problem when low water flow occurs, and phosphorus is the driving problem with it. A TMDL was already completed, approved by the state, and approved by the federal government for how we're going to deal with that. Part of the way that that pollution is going to be addressed is that if you are a point source water discharger, meaning a wastewater plant that has a permit, so city or industrial, and you want to increase how much phosphorus you are putting out of your facility, you need to find another facility in the watershed that will reduce how much they're putting out. And there's a 20% kicker on it. So if you need 100 pounds of phosphorus additional, you have to find someone to reduce 120 pounds. But that trading is allowed in that area. It's exactly the thing that the QCA was saying that had happened in the Annandale and Maple Lake case with the city of Litchfield, but there has been no completed assessment or a completed TMDL of that area yet. So the court ruling actually specifically says because the TMDL isn't done, you cannot do that offset. That's a huge problem for our facilities, our cities around the state. If literally each and every one of them, regardless of their overall benefit on the watershed, has to presume that they cannot have any increase of pollutant discharge in an area of the state that large. So the Annandale Maple Lake case really created a whole bunch of new problems for us. And the map that you see over here, we'll see two colors of dots. I think you have a copy of it in your packet as well, maybe. But if the dots aren't on it, take a look at this map after the hearing. The red dots are facilities that were known to already have a permit in process or to be expected to be applying for one within the next year, and have been told that because the because a TMDL is needed in their area and has not yet been completed, they cannot get a permit if they would cause or contribute further to that pollution problem. The green dots are in the hatched area, and they were essentially given the same notification, except they're in the Minnesota River TMDL area. So if they can find someone to offset their pollution, and their pollution issue would be phosphorus, they are able to go forward as long as they either don't increase their own discharge or they find someone else to trade with. That created about 70 facilities between cities and industries that were affected. There's two types of sources that are affected that you should be aware of. One is new discharges. So that would be a new discharge is a new pipe that discharges a pollutant. And if you look at that map, what you will see is very small cities getting their first wastewater plant and hoping to have some economic growth and development come out of the ability to handle more wastewater. And industries that are building somewhere where they need their own wastewater plant to handle their waste. Those are the two types of facilities affected by the restriction on new discharges. This part of the state has a couple significant ones with Minnesota Steel and with Excelsior Energy, both needing new water permits within this discharge area. The expanded discharge, when you look at that, you'll see that that tends to be more growing areas that already have wastewater or businesses that are trying to expand. So we had a number of ethanol plants because there's a lot of growth going on in that business right now that fall into that category, but also a number of the cities in the growth areas of the state, including the wastewater treatment facilities for the metro area in the Met Council's service area. Mr. Chair, with that, I guess I could certainly stop for questions on how we got to where we're at and respond as best I can.
First, I'll bring you the one that's been working. So you want to hold something like that.
Why don't we, let's go back to Representative Oz, who has some further information he'd like to share with the audience and his members on the bill. And then we'll have public testimony, and then we'll have an interactive discussion with questions and further interchange of information. So, Representative Oz.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I want to mention with regard to the bill, Section 9, I believe, has some language in there with regard to fees. As was mentioned earlier, there was a fee that was going to be raised from the plus tax that was taken out of the bill last year. There is currently in the bill, as it rests right now in the tax committee, has a language in it that talks about raising fees off of the property parcels. And the legislature really is looking at trying to drop all of those fee proposals because they have been very controversial, and to see if we can focus on getting general fund dollars. And we know that the budget situation has been a little better. We won't really know until February as to how much better or if it's early. Those decisions will have to be made in the future. But I know that in talking with the administration as well as with my colleagues in the House, we're looking at general fund. The Senate proposal already has general fund requesting it. So that the bill that passed from the Senate, I believe, is focusing on general fund. And so that, I think, takes with help a great deal in taking out some of the controversy so that people can really focus on what this bill is trying to do, and that is trying to provide for a funding mechanism that we would be able to establish policy in the state of Minnesota. Right now, everything that the bill calls for is currently possible and can be done under the current law, both either at the federal level and or at the state level. But by establishing it in specific policy toward programs, then we're able to really come to the legislature and say, if you would support this program to a certain level, here's how those dollars would be spent. And then we establish that in a way that through statute, so that future administrations cannot deviate from that without going back to the legislative process and saying, okay, they want to change how we're going to handle this in the future. So we're really trying to get this to where the state agencies will coordinate together. We want them to talk together. We want them to, when they make a decision that's going to impact the people at the local level, that they'll communicate that directly down. And each agency will have the same interpretation as to what's going on, so that we don't get mixed messages going out there to the people that are trying to work hard to come into compliance with the Federal Clean Water Act. And we think that by then channeling the dollars to where it will, the decisions on the total maximum daily load plans will actually be made at the grassroots level. Very often, because the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency does not have the personnel to do all this by itself, and we don't want to establish that kind of a huge bureaucracy. We don't want to have another floor put on a building down in St. Paul to try and do this. We would rather have those dollars actually going out to help clean up the water and to make good quality decisions that's based on common sense and science. And so we want to have the people at the grassroots be presented the information. Very often the third parties that would be dealing with this are your soil and water conservation districts or your watershed districts or other counties. It can be any of those types of organizations that the MPCA, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, feels can actually carry out the functions. But at all times, the bill clearly says that the MPCA is the one that's in charge. Matter of fact, we are, to make that even clearer, I'm going to suggest that the, when we're looking at how the third-party provisions are actually dealt with, like on page 3, if you have a copy of the bill with you, it's on page 3, starting at line 29. At the end of that section, in subdivision 9, it states that when they deal with a push control agency, deals with a third party, it must be consistent with the bill's policies and priorities within section 114D.20. I believe we should also add 114D.25, which is also a large section within this bill that outlines all the types of things that you need to be doing with regard to putting together your local plans, notifications that have to go out to the public, appeals processes that would be taking place. So we don't have decisions to be made in Minnesota that would then not have opportunity for people to actually appeal those things through a contested case hearing type process. If there are problems with the way things are being put together, before the MPCA and anything that's done at the TMDL has to be approved by the MPCA, so it eventually has to go to that level. We want to make sure that anyone that objects to components or pieces of it can do so right here in Minnesota. They don't have to wait for this to go all the way out to the EPA, and then when the Environmental Protection Agency at the federal level is trying to make decisions, that they would have to go into a contested case hearing or court cases, be much more costly at that point. We want to try and have this be approached with common sense and efficiencies. We believe people at the grassroots can do that. When you know what the problems are within your individual watersheds, and keep in mind, that's what happens with regard to impaired waters. That impaired water is going to be that pond or that lake or that river that's right there in your watershed. And there are things that have to be evaluated as where is that pollution coming from, or that problem being created, and how are you going to be able to deal with it? And each one of those have to be dealt with separately. For example, if you have an impairment that's from fecal coliform, That's different than phosphorus. Mm-hmm. If you have also a phosphorus problem, you're going to have to have two TMDLs. And so we want to provide the dollars, the common sense, the assistance to get those evaluated, but to make certain that as those decisions are made, people at the local level can understand the problem, and you can start to figure out, well, where is it coming from? And how can we maybe change our lifestyles a little bit? Because very often you're going to find, especially with phosphorus, it's not one source. That end of the pipe type of problem is not that those things we've been dealing with since 1972, when the Clean Water Act actually went into effect. We've been focusing on end of the pipe pollution. We're taking care of most of those situations, or are continuing working on them. We've identified the problems and how to address them. What we need to now do is to deal with all the little bits of pollution that each and every one of us are creating. And it's not a violation as we are doing our individual action, but when it aggregates together within that pond or within that lake or that stream, then we end up with a problem. And so we want to have that problem addressed, but where local communities can get some assistance in addressing it. They shouldn't have to do this all on their own. We're all part of it. We think we should all be involved in helping clean it up. And that's what we're, in order to do that, we need to have good quality policy that's been approved at the state level so that we have some assurance and accountability that this is how the process is going to work in this policy state. That's the intent of what's happening here. And I stand for the questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Osmond. And I want to also bring to the audience here tonight the amount of time that this committee has spent on this bill up to tonight. In 2005, before this committee and others, about 16 hours of testimony were given and questions answered on this bill, as well as 6 hours of testimony and discussion in other cities in LeSueur, Annandale, Maple Lake, now tonight, and tomorrow at the Lakeview Castle in Duluth at 10 o'clock. And this is all part of an outreach program, these last pieces of that testimony and the information received in exchange is all part of an outreach that, because this is a statewide issue, because it's a statewide problem, and I think that some people have stated that someday our water will be more valuable than oil, we should probably be looking out for our investments as soon as possible. Also, one of the more controversial parts of the bill, and quite a bit of skepticism about the bill, has been at any time when you talk about millions or fives of millions or tens of millions or 800s of millions, you start to wonder where the money's going to go. And one of the things that I think is important for you to know is where it's proposed, how much it is going to be as a proposal, how long that proposal is going to have life behind it, and where the money might go during the expected life of the impact of this bill. So I'd like to ask Mr. Johnson to come back forward for a moment. We'll try that microphone. And I know he knows the answers to these questions, and that might answer some of the questions that you might be bringing forward tonight. So, Mr. Johnson, do you understand my question to you? Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, can anyone hear me? All right. Yes, I understand the question. The proposal that is in front of us right now.
You got
them both? I see. Try again. Can anyone hear me now? The proposal that will be coming to the legislature this year, or at least what's being recommended by the G16 as its proposal this year, is for initial general fund or other appropriate statewide funding source monies for a startup that would need to provide about $40 million. Most of that, in fact, almost all of that, goes for on-the-ground work or for getting these studies done so that we can determine what has to happen in various communities. The long-term funding for this has been calculated to be about an $80 million per year need. That amount is almost entirely for restoration activity. So for new infrastructure that will be required in communities, or for technical assistance and financial assistance for voluntary efforts by private property owners on their own land, it will leverage several times that in additional federal money. The agricultural parts of this will all kinds of detailed numbers. Agricultural parts of this will leverage up to an additional $40 million per year of federal ag bill money, depending on where the funding for the federal ag bill is by then. The wastewater infrastructure money would significantly, many times over, generate local investment money to build that infrastructure. The funding will be needed for a period of at least 10 years. That's how long it will take us to complete the initial go-through of Minnesota's water and to get the TMDLs that are currently slated to be done. And in fact, we actually have a calendar right now for TMDLs that carries us out beyond that time period. It's a 13-year calendar that we have to complete these. Once a water is found to be impaired, you have 13 years to complete the study on how you're going to fix it, or you open yourself up to a new round of federal lawsuits, which we try to avoid doing whenever we can. The places where that money goes, I think, are very key, and a lot of work was put by this group into determining where the money needed to go and in what amounts. To start with, more than 75% of the funds, both in the startup plan and in the ongoing out-year funding, wherever that might come from, goes to on-the-ground restoration work, either grants or low-interest loans. I'll go into a little bit about what that means for restoration work or for technical assistance to get those done. The rest of the money goes for the science needed to know what we're supposed to do. So there is funding for the Pollution Control Agency, either itself or with expert contractors, to do the modeling to determine where the pollution is coming from in an impaired water and figure out how we're going to put a plan together to fix it. There's money to do the assessment and monitoring needed to find out if the water has a problem in the first place. And there is money for the other state agencies, DNR, Ag, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources, to add technical assistance to their programs so that the people that they regularly work with, the farmers, the landowners, the lakeshore residents, have someone who can tell them what types of practices to do that won't be wasting time and money. The total out-year complement of state employees is, I believe, 38 to 38 and a half total for all state agencies combined is all that would be added in this. All the rest of the money would go through to either local governments or to other programs that go out as low-interest loans, the Ag BMP Loan Fund, other programs like that. For cities specifically, we have three major places where the money goes in here that are very significant. One is a new program for 50% grant, 50% loan funding for small communities to replace failed septic systems. So if your community has massive failing septic systems, which most of our small older communities do, rather than having to put a proposal together and get in line with every big city in the state and wait for funding for 5 or 10 years on the project priority list, there would be a $4.5 million per year fund established that only small cities replacing failed septic systems would be eligible to receive. Secondly, there is a prosperous grants program that in the out years of this bill would receive $15 million per year. It is to provide grants for communities that have to install additional phosphorus treatment to their wastewater plants. We already have over 100 facilities in the state that have been required to do that. There's about 120 more that are going to be required to do that, and it ranges in some facilities that are very low-tech. It can be inexpensive. It might be only $50,000 to do this. In other larger, complicated facilities, it might be several million dollars to do this. And right now, it's a completely unfunded mandate that's going on all new wastewater facilities as part of the state's effort to minimize phosphorus going into the state waters throughout the state. This program would provide a 75% grant for that phosphorus reduction technology to any facility, whether it is a new one requiring it or whether it's one that has added that treatment since March of 2000. So it is going retroactive to any facilities that have already done that, which I think is a very fair thing, and it's been supported by the entire G16. That was a big victory for cities. We have previously not had a lot of support from environmental groups for grants for those programs, and I think they've realized that the burden of this treatment is significant and that it's worth the state chipping in to help us do it. And then finally, the bill asks for additional resources to go into the state revolving fund. That's a low-interest loan program for wastewater, drinking water, or stormwater infrastructure that's publicly owned. And essentially, the state subsidizes the interest rates, and they also have the ability to substantially increase the amount of money available by issuing tax-exempt bonds to put a multiplier effect on the money. Mr. Kuhlman from the Public Facility Authority is here today if you'd like to ask detailed questions about that. But the net result is that we are trying to generate about $45 million a year more of revenue for that fund. We have 231 projects, of wastewater treatment projects, sitting in line in this state right now waiting for adequate funding to get funding through the state revolving fund. And that's not decreasing. We are not funding these projects faster than the backlog is building. As these new requirements start coming in and communities find out they can't grow unless they put in new wastewater treatment, that's going to increase. And we also have many of your communities are now starting to experience new stormwater regulations. And I think more and more you're going to hear over the next 5 years that cities are going to be needing financial access to this fund for those stormwater projects. Because in a community that is not growing rapidly, to suddenly retrofit their community for stormwater treatment as a pollution control technique instead of as a flood control technique is going to be very expensive. So that is a quick summary, Mr. Chair. And if you have specific questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Well, I believe, Mr. Johnson, I heard you say that of the $80 million that's proposed, $20 million then would be for the actual study to determine which water is unfair each year over the course of 10 years, is that correct? And you said 75% was going to actual on-the-ground programs in 2025. So is that accurate? $20 million for MPCA to get the study done of our statewide water inventory.
Mr. Chair and members, it is about $20 million, but that includes some assistance staffing in some other agencies. And then the rest of the money, about $60 million a year, is for on-the-ground work in other various programs.
And you mentioned, Mr. Johnson, several times in the out years. Can you let people know, for those who aren't going to know on these things, what the out years mean? Not out years, but out years.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the jargon alert. When we refer to the out years in budgeting, we are simply talking about the next biennium and further biennia beyond that. The state budgets 2 years at a time. We currently have 1 year left in this funding cycle, so the $40 million amount we are looking for would be to carry us through the rest of this biennium. In the out years, what we are actually going to be requesting is that the $80 million per year be put in the base budget for discussions in the next budget cycle, and that the decision can be made at that time what funding source is appropriate for it, whether it's general fund or other sources that exist. But it would assure that as the governor puts forward a budget in the next cycle, this issue is one of the issues discussed in that budget.
Yeah. And also, we're going to have questions from other members here in a moment, so if you just stay up here. Another thing I wanted to again go over is another item in this bill that is someone reported to a lot of cities, even though as Representative Osmond said, we've been dealing with the pipe solutions, the end of the pipe for years. Give you an example, for those in the audience, the small community that I live in, Crane Lake, just installed a central sewer system and sewered about 180 homes. And one of the conditions of the permit was to put a phosphorus precipitation and control unit on our wastewater treatment plant. I forget the cost, it was $500,000, something, $600,000, $400,000, I don't remember, it was a lot. And so this bill would provide a 75% reimbursement for the cost of that installation, as I understand it, and then the court would apply that to our debt service by down our existing debt on the plan. And that anybody who did that from March of 2000 up to present and beyond would be eligible for that 75% grant. So we're kind of grandfathering in those who took the action and did it right in the first place. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. One other very important point about this is a new funding source. There is no such grant program at all right now, no funding for this. But those red dots you see on that map and the green dots are places that would have to reduce their phosphorus pollution to zero increase if they wanted an expansion of their facility or have no impact as a new facility. What this grant would do is say that, for instance, Annandale and Maple Lake could build their new facility by adding additional phosphorus treatment. This would provide 75% of the cost of them doing that to get around the restriction that would otherwise prevent them from building a wastewater plant.
Can I speak to that point?
Okay, we'll hear from Representative Rubino.
Well, to that point, before this summit, no, I think I can speak louder.
Yes.
To that map that you just referred to, I am puzzled. There aren't any, there's more dots in Representative Bill's district than there are people. So, and I'm not being facetious, that's an absolute fact. Those dots are all up to the boundary water, and so I'm wondering, where is there a total maximum daily load requirement in the boundary waters when there's no people? So is the federal government going to clean up their own act, or is that on state school trust land, and are they going to clean up their act? Because all these dots are where there's no people. So maybe Mr. French or Ms. Boss or someone can tell us who we're cleaning up.
Mr. Chair, I'd be more than happy to let the Pollution Control Agency answer that one. I can give a quick summary. When the red dots I was pointing to were on the furthest right maps, not the one with the scattering of boundary waters dots, I'm sure that most of those dots are mercury issues in lakes, impairments for mercury and fish tissue. That's an issue the Pollution Control Agency has already completed a statewide TMDL on that is being discussed at their board meeting tomorrow. So that's why we're kind of skimming over that a little bit. But you're right. In my opinion, representing cities who are regulated for mercury discharge, that we have very little we can do at the state level to affect the mercury levels in those lakes right now from our water discharge permits. That's not what's affecting them.
However, I would like to point out that along the North Shore, virtually every river from the Western River, from the Loop, and actually even to the west and south, south and west of the Loop, almost every river is affected by a turbidity impairment. So, I mean, even though mercury obviously is a problem in the Northeast and the composition of the lakes and how we get the mercury in there from air deposition and we still have some other impairments that are known that we need to deal with, but maybe Mr. French could give us some information on that, specific to the museum in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, had to hold it real close now.
Okay, this should be on.
Just the light, if I said, you do that.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm also trying to bring this up with the board agency and native appearance, so it feels good to be back on the range, as it were. These maps, in fact, Craig was correct. These dots, all but a handful of them are mercury impairments for lakes in the area. And in addition, we think we all put into a statewide CMBL on a completely different track. Another thing to understand about these impairments is that they are caused primarily through the deposition of mercury from atmospheric sources, not from applied discharges. So this creates an intersect between the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, which I don't mean to get into tonight, but it stands to place to say you are correct. These are what are called conventional impairments here, which may have some of the same concerns as the earlier one this area. You have in your packets a multi-page two-page document called Draft EPCA 3034. This map shows all of the impairments caused to conditions, including what type they are. The detail behind those dots can be found on these various pages by the representation, whether it's the Great Lakes of the Clear Basin, the Green River, or the northern portion of the upper Mississippi. And there you can see the difference between the transitional pollutants, the important lakes, and the biocumulative, which are primarily mercury or PCBs. So you have the information on what's deeper than the transitional.
Yes, I think that does. And now, we'll just have questions from the committee. First, we'll have our representative jump in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today, maybe the same in our PCAU or the most step there. Explain again real slowly, because again, my friend Senator Cadena knows I'm from farm country, and I'm not real quick down there. Tell me again what the brown here, what's the significance of this big brown blob you keep showing us here? Why is that there? What are you trying to tell us with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, having grown up in your farm area between Kandy, Ohio County and Chippewa County, I understand it and I appreciate the need for explanation. The big brown area there, the tan area, is the Lake Pepin watershed. So all the water from the state that drains to Lake Pepin. Lake Pepin is a natural lake on the Mississippi River. I actually grew up not knowing that. I thought there was a dam there or something. Turns out I was wrong. But what it includes in Minnesota is the Minnesota River drainage, the Upper Mississippi drainage, and the section of the St. Croix River that drains in Minnesota. So that entire tan area is the area that drains to Lake Pepin, and anything that occurs in that area related to discharge of phosphorus, because phosphorus is an element and will slowly move down a river unless there's a place for it to settle out, is considered to potentially affect Lake Pepin. The hatched area on the Minnesota River is the area that is included in the lower Minnesota part of that basin, and it already has a federally approved way of handling phosphorus limits. So slightly different regulations apply there. The communities or facilities in that area have the option of doing this pollutant trading solution, which the non-hatched tan area does not have as an option. The other colored areas around here are simply just CMBLs for different pollutants in other parts of the state.
But again, what does it mean? I understand the watersheds. What does it mean? Why are you drawing it there? What does it mean for Wilmer, Minnesota, or Richfield, or Minneapolis and St. Paul? What does that mean? Why are we concerned?
What it means for Wilmer or Litchfield or Minneapolis and St. Paul, thank you very much for asking for clarification, Mr. Chair, Representative, is that if you are going to develop or need a permit for development for expansion of either wastewater or stormwater in a way that would increase the turbidity or phosphorus problems in Lake Pepin, you will be told that is not a legal development. So if you are trying to increase the capacity of your wastewater plant because you're expecting a lot of new houses in the community, and it would also at the same time increase the amount of phosphorus you're discharging, you can't do it.
And Mr. Chair, I guess maybe a comment and maybe some more questions, but first of all, I find that incredible to believe
believe that that would be followed through to that point eventually. But, I mean, that's Minneapolis-St. Paul. When you talk about development going on, we've turned on it. Well, you know, we haven't stopped any development yet in our part of the country. We just turned on our ethanol plant. Grand Falls just turned on theirs. So then it had not stopped anything. And I'm not understanding why it's about a court case.
Yeah.
With Annandale, they basically is what's spurring this. And again, the EPCA, we've had this Clean Water Act since 1972, 34 years. And now all of a sudden it's a major issue. Now, quite frankly, that I think we're doing some Clean Water things a lot better than what we've done in the past. Is this all because of a single court case? Is that what you're trying to tell us here?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. What I would say is that the reason you have this map here is because that court case got to the point it is at. However, it has, in fact, stopped development. Annandale Maple Lake, at their last city council meeting, had to reject a permit for over 100 new housing units at the Annandale City Council because they do not have the wastewater capacity without this new plant. So we actually do have development being affected by it already. And yes, it does. If you look on the border right by the Twin Cities area, you'll see MCES Hastings. That's the Met Council's wastewater treatment for the Southern Metro at Hastings. They have already been. This TMDL has been completed, or unless they can somehow get their phosphorus to not have any increase, it's being tremendously expensive.
Mr. Chair, let me ask a question. When we run into trouble in courts in the state courts and state law, typically the legislature will revisit and redo, as we all know, whether it's a strong issue or whatever the issue is. We have 10 people sitting out in Washington, D.C. Where are they in redoing? You are not going to stop development in that whole brown area. It's not going to happen, I predict. And why are we not addressing this federally to make that change so that the courts are clear on what this means, that we can do a cumulative, like you said, Litchfield is putting in, so it will actually be less, yet that was turned down by the courts. That's number one. And number two, again, maybe PCA can weigh in on this. It appears to me that Minnesota, and I look at states that might have a lot of water, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan come to mind, probably Alaska, down south Florida, Louisiana, something. Not many other states have a lot of water like this. So why is Minnesota, number one, being required probably to do more than anyone else? And number two, what are these other water states doing? I hope we're not reinventing the wheel. And number three, where is the federal money to help this? Because again, if you look at the mercury up here in the northern part, as you pointed out, I suspect that only what, and PCA can tell me again, is it 12%, 15%? How much of that mercury is native? And how much is atmospheric that comes from other places other than Minnesota? And again, how are we supposed to address a problem like that? And it really isn't our problem. It's coming from elsewhere. So I know there's a number of questions or concerns, but it gets down to this money thing. We're being asked for $80 million a year. No one's arguing, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair, we shouldn't clean this up and do our due diligence. And all of a sudden, we're in a panic here because of a lawsuit. And I'd like to know what our federal delegation is going to do on this and what's going on in Washington. And again, and why, as one of the few water states in this country, are we getting more assistance from federal resources and being asked to do so much? Obviously, North and South Dakota have the largest problem of $80 million.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'll try and get through a couple of those, and I'll actually let the Pollution Control Agency answer a number of them, because obviously the cities of the state agree substantially with you that this is a major concern. It is not something new, however. We're not doing anything. Florida is spending a fortune on this right now. Maryland has spent a fortune dealing with the Chesapeake Bay. We have many states, California, others, and it is not just a case of an environmental lawsuit in Minnesota driving this. The Farm Bureau has been suing all over the country on this issue for the better part of a decade, trying to get these TMDLs done appropriately in other parts of the country. We actually are one of the later states doing it, as you pointed out, and the other states you list join us in that distinction because we're part of EPA's fifth region, which is the Great Lakes, the Great Lakes Delta, very high water states. It's Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. So we have a lot of the water to deal with there, and frankly, I don't know that there's a reason why they've let us get away with it as it is this time. I think it's because they appreciated the fact that we had no idea how we were going to get it done. But we do have to get it done at some point. And the federal lawsuits are a reality. They really do happen. They've happened elsewhere. Montana couldn't build roads for a year and a half, any roads, because of a lawsuit under this that was successfully brought. And the federal law, despite many problems with the Clean Water Act over the years, we've had cities being sued since the Clean Water Act was put into effect for various violations under it, constantly a cry for both grant money for cities to meet these requirements and for relief from some of the environmental mandates caused by them. And Congress, regardless of administration or balance of party, has been unwilling to reopen the Clean Water Act to make those changes. So with that in mind, we have not been counting on Congress making changes. We have to figure out how we're going to be able to keep our cities moving forward under the current set of regulations. As to where the federal money is, it's going away quickly. We just have seen in the last 2 years a 33% reduction in federal money coming for wastewater treatment for cities in the nationwide, just in Minnesota. So our federal government is rapidly cutting its environmental spending right now, not increasing it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Duffy, how far did he get in answering the multiple questions?
What about federal? We do have some. Don't tell me the federal government can't do anything, because we do have a delegation that's fairly well versed, that have an inside route to the administration, that are in the majority, frankly, of both bodies. I mean, we've got some things we should do. Where are we with that? And why aren't they addressing specifically the lawsuit and any further development on that, even part of that realm?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jackie, I knew I would have the opportunity to do this tonight. I want to reflect a little bit, as our friend Senator Federson did in the Senate much of last year. The origin of the Clean Water Act comes out of, actually, this congressional district in Minnesota. Congressman John Blatnick is well-renowned across the nation as the guru of clean water. He was the chief author. As I was in high school in the late 1960s, he was slaving away in Congress with a young staff person named Jim Rubenstein crafting this legislation, in part, I think, to reflect the values of Minnesotans, which was clean water was a very closely held belief that we have in this state. So I want to bring it home first to the fact that John Blatnick and Jim Oberstar are key and integral players in the Clean Water Act and have been for over 30, 40 years. With that having been said, I believe the current delegation is well aware, as are delegations from other states, about the complexities that this law creates. Congress has not seen fit to go back and undo the work of the legislation of the act that Richard Nixon signed in 1972. So here we sit today attempting to implement it as best we can. A very complex statute, a statute with laudable goals, but conflicting tensions on growth, development, and protection of the environment. The group that has assembled here in Minnesota has perhaps gone further than any other group in the country, and their work is recognized thus far, even though there's no statute or law passed yet. Their work is recognized as cutting edge in bringing together all of the diverse stakeholders, ranging from the Farm Bureau to the environmental organizations, to the cities, to the chambers of commerce and industry, bringing those people together on the same page to say this is something that we need to do in Minnesota, both for the benefit of the environment and our economic future. On the mercury issue, that is a team deal of a different color, and it has been drafted. 90% approximately of the pollutants deposited in Minnesota, of the mercury deposit, is coming from regional, national, or global sources. So we share about 10% of the responsibility. The draft TMDL that is under discussion right now within Minnesota would take steps towards Minnesota moving to do its fair share in conjunction with other parties doing their fair share to reduce mercury. And just to make this statement here tonight, as one who comes to Lake Vermilion regularly and fishes and is a consumer of those that I'm lucky enough to catch, even if all of the mercury emissions in Minnesota were dropped to zero today, we would still have fish tissue mercury issues. The mercury is ubiquitous, it is global, and it's a serious issue that we all must address together, and we'll grapple with it over the next year or two, or 10, or 20.
Any other questions for the members?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is, I think, for Mr. Finn. How much of the mercury that we see here, and I know it's another part of the state, is due to the soil? I know you said 90% is regional, national, and international, and so on, but we do know that some soils are a lot heavier in mercury content than others. So, could someone address that? And then how do we clean that up?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll take a quick shot at it and someone from the PCA can stand up. I was part of a mercury effluent limits working group to discuss this. About 90%, as Mr. French pointed out earlier, of our mercury comes from out of state. Of the part that is from within the state, a maximum of about 2% comes from our water discharges. So about 8% is from other sources. A good percent of that, depending on where you are in the state, could be naturally occurring. We do have naturally occurring mercury in the soil in most cases.
Any other questions for the members? Senator Levine? Okay, the first person I'd like to testify. I see Mr. Hanson back in the back nodding his head. Mr. Hanson, would you like to come forward and testify if that's your wish? And who's Representative Bob, who has something you'd like to add?
Members, I'd like you to know that with regard to this particular bill, and I know questions have come up with regard to mercury, but this bill is really looking at TMDL evaluations. That will happen watershed by watershed. When we're dealing with something as large as mercury, that's being handled in a whole different process, as has been mentioned a couple of times. This particular bill is trying to deal with how do we manage the dollars and the coordination and the effort to get right down to the issues that are happening in each of our backyards using the science that's actually developed in that backyard, because we don't want one size fits all. Why should restrictions go on activity all across the state of Minnesota when it only may affect a small portion of that state? Let's put these things together, watershed by watershed, affecting the water bodies that are actually impaired for that specific impairment, keeping this as narrow as possible so that we do not interfere with the activities of people out there in Minnesota. And we're not putting out a bunch of regulations trying to use a shotgun when a rice water is actually that needs to be developed.
Thank you. And if you would try to use the microphone, because it works most of the time, have to hold it nice and close. And also, if you would introduce yourself and who you represent. I think there's two buttons on it, maybe in the on position.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members with me. My name is Clyde Hanson. I'm a volunteer for the Sierra Club. I live in Wilson, Minnesota. I'm a co-chair of Mining Without Harm campaign. I'm here today because the Sierra Club theme is mentioned a lot with the bill, and that's in the blogosphere, and I wanted all of you to know about the Sierra Club and this bill so you could communicate to your constituents. One is that, and specifically about the third-party PBML development, there's a lot of discussion that the Sierra Club was going to be somehow creating PDMLs for various watersheds in the state of Minnesota. Now, the problem with that is, one, we do not take government contracts, and we do not take grants from the government, state, federal, local. So we would never be engaged in such an endeavor. So you can repeat that to your constituents, people who serve without us doing PDMLs. The second one is, we do support the polluter pays principle for the clean water legacy we have. And we think that's good fiscal policy because you get better bang for your buck. Because just the fact that funding the restoration work is going to prevent future pollution. So we encourage that once you get beyond the startup year, you go back and think about ways to tax pollution so that less of it happens and that smart business people can find ways to do their process and make their product, conduct their businesses with doing without regulation, without command and control, but just finding better ways to do it so they don't have to pay pollution tax. And then thirdly, we'd just like to reinforce the state of urgency that we need to get going cleaning up our waters in Minnesota. 1972 was like a long time ago. We had some big challenges back then when lakes were catching on fire and things. We've made some progress, but our goal, remember, was fishable, swimmable waters. We just have got a way to go there. This process is the best way to apply science to do that, get on the ground, find the sources, do something about it. Funding it properly is a great thing to do, and pursuing supporting efforts to move it forward. Just wanted to share that with you today. So thanks for the time, and any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the members representing the meeting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Nancy. Funding is going to be a problem, and we can talk about all we want to at the table tonight that we can do this with less, but the fact of the matter is $80 million is still a lot of money for Diane where I come from up here, and so Mr. Hanson, you brought up a good concept in theory about taxing pollution, but let's talk about just right here in this district. You know, the steel industry, the tackle industry is, I guess, in a little mini-boom because pellets now are worth a lot more in the international market. We've actually even sold some pellets in China. But when you make mine iron ore, whether it's in Brazil or Slovakia or wherever, there are other mines, they have no standards to meet that we have to meet. So how does a tackle plant that until a few years ago, Minnesota was getting maybe $30 a ton delivered to the lower Great Lakes, compete with a Brazilian mine that has no environmental requirements whatsoever and can scoop it out of the ground, and they're causing severe hardship to the Amazon River Basin and probably, you know, putting a lot of pollutants, maybe some of that mercury that's coming up the North Shore where you live, in the air. How do we accomplish that in a global economy and be fair to my constituents who are working in those plants who are competing in an international market that's just so unfair?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thanks for that question. I don't have all the answers. We have been working with steelworkers for the last 10 years on global trade issues, trying to make the environment part of our global strategy for this country, and certainly the environment should not be a place where you can get a competitive advantage against other countries in the world. But these natural resources, for example, always have value, and now they go up in value if they're going to be mined up somewhere else, and Brazil's going to work through those things. Certainly our resources are going to be more valuable in the future. But we can only control what we can control in this world, and what we can think we can do. A lot of the mine companies opposed the formation of labor unions, they opposed the livable wage, they opposed health and welfare benefits. So I'm a little skeptical of granting them the right to use our public waters as a sink for waste in a matter of competitiveness. We could be smart enough to do it, to clean up our waters and still have jobs. So I would say I think we can try harder. If you don't control Minnesota, that's where we are, this is our home, and I think we could set an example for the rest of the world.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that answer, Mr. Hanson. I don't necessarily disagree at all with what you said. But when you close a mine like LCD and its pipeworks that produce 7 million tons of oil a year, and replace that oil with 7 million tons coming from the Ukraine, how did we accomplish anything for our Minnesota constituents by doing that?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm not sure I can explain why I would help you with bankruptcy. I don't know that it was because of environmental regulation or law. I was expecting it to do with more management, quality management decisions over a very long period of time. I don't know that environmental standards, quality, or investments would have made any difference.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hanson, you're probably right to a degree, but I'm sure I'll just give you an example of steelworkers' health care. It costs about $3 a ton, that's what I've been told, by the steelworkers and by the company, actually, to provide health care for steelworkers versus in Canada, where their health care is paid for by the government. So, I'm sure, Mr. Scipione here, if you want to back and I just put in a $27 million scrubber of more, he says $30 million, amortize that over 7 million tons a year, or 5 million tons a year, how much that is a ton, and there's a significant environmental cost there too, and now Minpac is going to have to, I believe, put in. Mr. Scipione, you probably know that, although we're not at that plant anymore, but I don't know what the cost is, probably going to be more than $30 million. And, you know, they should have to clean up. I agree with you 100%, Mr. Hanson, but, you know, to put on top of that $30 million, they've got to put to clean that scrubber, another tax, because, you know, they cost theoretically some pollution, I think jeopardizes our jobs in a way that we just can't compete unless we can get them. I agree that there should be a tax on Slovakian ore and Ukrainian ore and Brazilian ore coming into this country. We should tax the hell out of it, much more than I'd like to tax my own mining company from Minnesota for production. That's a whole other issue.
All right, thank you very much.
Just a clarification, Representative Rupert, is there anything you just spoke about that's in this bill that's been...
Not at all for you, but we have a spokesman. Mr. Chair, and Representative Martin, we have a spokesman from the environmental community up here that is proposing a tax that will tax maybe Minnesota's ore operations, would tax Minnesota's power, would tax anybody that puts out, and that's their proposal, and I know yours is just a, you know, kind of a no-minnow left behind tax, no child left behind, we can grab money out of the air to pay for this, so.
All right. The next person who went to testify, anyone like to ask my, you have your hand up? Introduce yourself on that nice microphone there, hold it close, and we represent.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, welcome to Minnesota's Iron Range. My name is Frank Tangaro. I'm the president of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. We represent the 6 producing taconite plants in Minnesota and just under 200 additional businesses that supply products, goods, and services to the mines. I'm here today on behalf of the industry in support of the Clean Water Legacy Act. It's simply an issue that needs to be addressed and moved forward for a variety of reasons. Not only are we concerned about the health and wellness of the people in the region and assuring our natural resources are sound for the future, but we're very concerned about the future economics of this issue as it relates to the industry. The impact of the federal law, the Clean Water Act, is of great concern to the industry. Obviously, if no new or expanded discharge, unless the TMDL is complete, is the threshold, then a lot of the large projects that are either being proposed by existing facilities or the multitude of proposed projects of new mining opportunities that are possibilities for future economic development enhancement in this region are not able to go forward. That could be a huge economic impact, detrimental economic impact to the region of northeastern Minnesota. The industry currently has just under 4,000 workers directly employed in the mines and plants, at least another 10,000 people employed in hundreds of supplier businesses spread all across the state of Minnesota in most every district, granted mostly in northeastern Minnesota, but companies all across the state. And last year's direct economic benefit to the state of Minnesota, basically payroll benefits, purchases, taxes and royalties, was about $1.5 billion. That doesn't even get into the economic multipliers and spin-offs that go along with that. We're fortunate to have a brief economic snapshot in time where, because of the global forces that Representative Rukavina mentioned, there's some actual demand for this product, and that hasn't always been the case. And this is a time where these companies are looking to existing companies invest in their existing facilities, as referenced with the U.S. Steel Key Tack project. I think three other companies currently have major permit issues in front of the state agencies. A couple have gone forward, and with the North Shore Furnace 5 and Wasabi Nugget, there are some permits in place. Those are good things, but there are a lot of additional projects that are possibilities that could be severely impacted if this issue is not adequately addressed. The industry stands committed to working with you, Mr. Chairman, and the Range delegation to make sure that this can move forward in a way that is helpful not only to the entire state in being good stewards of our resources, but also ways that can continue to drive the industry, the economics, and the jobs, and the return of the revenues back to our communities. I wasn't clear exactly what was mentioned as far as the last comments about the industry and its relationship to its feelings on some issues, so I just want to state that the industry is very concerned about being good steward of our Minnesota resources. We promote well in excess of livable wages and benefits, and health and safety of the workers in this industry is paramount. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'll stand for any questions.
Mr. Rivera, how are you represented? Mr. Johnson referenced a working group called the G16 that's been the formulation group of this, for the results, the bill as it stands today, essentially, plus the work of the 2005 legislature, certainly. How were you represented? How was the industry's representation on that G16 working group? And tell us a little bit about how you gave your industry gave input into that, or were you directly on the G16?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, obviously, Minnesota Iron Mining is just one of many industries in the state of Minnesota with that will be directly impacted by this issue. And through the leadership of the Minnesota Chamber, the iron mining industry had significant input directly to that group in that process. Each facility, each ownership, if not each plant, has had environmental engineers working very closely with working groups within working groups to give advice and input into the proposals as it's gone forward, and have been supportive of that process.
And thank you, and thank you very much. And Mr. Hansen, hear the question, and could you answer the question as well? Did you hear the question that I asked Mr. Andrade? I asked, what input did your organization have to the G16 group? What opportunity did you have to give them your ideas as they formulated this bill, and then we have worked on since then?
We were not directly on the G16 group. There were two environmental organizations represented. It was rather frustrating process to get ideas from that group.
Thank you. Who is next to testify?
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Absolutely. Representative Rukavina.
It's related. Mr. Gar, you heard, Mr. Hansen before you talk about some perhaps type of pollution tax. Now, you kind of talked about everyone wants clean water, and you know that. And we have some water issues that are rearing their ugly head, I guess you could call it that, here in the very near future. And by the way, for Range people in the audience, I'd like to recognize Ann Fox from the PCA, who's done a remarkable job working with us. And if you would stand up, she's tried to work very hard with the delegation and keep it in mind, protecting the environment and also hearing some of our concerns about what that does. And you point up here, particularly your, your group of, that you represent. The other day, I think we met with Cleveland Cliffs, and their stocks have gone from $19 a share, I believe one of their big shots told us, to $180 and then split a share in the last 2 years. From $19 to $180, even with my north side math, that's about a 10 times. I'm the world's worst capitalist, so I can have Representative Bill help me out, but that's a tenfold increase. Don't you think there should be some obligation? And I know U.S. steel stocks have also skyrocketed in that time period. Now we are looking at, in U.S. steel's case, that tailings pond leaking and having to, there's a request to the PCA about having some water put into some of the streams and some creeks that head north out of them. I'd like to see us address that, and do you think that mining companies have some obligation during good times to maybe set some money aside on their own and possibly come to us with an idea, whether it's to use Mr. Coleman's RIF money or whatever, to treat that wastewater that they've actually been self-containing, good about it, good stewards, but now the time has come, we've got to do something, we've got to address it in U.S. steel case this year. Do you have an obligation in industry to put some money aside for it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, real quickly, yes, we've seen some individual corporate quarterly profits go up, and profitability is a positive thing. That's what drives the industry. At the same time, a few good quarters does not make up for dozens of bad quarters in a row. To the point of the question, obviously all of these companies with their projects, whether it's discharge, whether it's emissions, have been and continue to make significant investment in making sure that they are meeting these standards and being good stewards for that environment, and will continue to do so. I think a fair and equitable approach to making sure that there's no undue burden for any one payor for this process is important. And as we go forward, we look forward as an industry to working closely with you as a delegation and through the committee to see what we can do to resolve this so that the industry can continue to invest and be solid for when that next down cycle does get here.
Anything further, Representative at this point?
Very good.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Garland. And who would like to testify next? Come forward and give your name. And you've got a sign-in sheet there. You sign in on that before you leave, and also who you represent. And both switches have to be on. You have to hold it closed. They're both on the side.
Can you hear me? My name is Roland Cleveland. I'm a dairy farmer down in North Branch, Minnesota, believe it or not. But I'm on the Soil and Water Conservation District Board. And this is part of Area 3, which I'm a co-director. And to answer some questions before they arise, we were a direct, the Soil and Water Conservation Districts were a direct member of the G16. Leanne Buck, our executive director, participated in that. I'd like to just speak on behalf of that bill. I guess the main thing is the Soil and Water Conservation Districts would be one of those grassroots types organizations which would be out there helping start with probably to do some of the TMDL work and also implementing projects out there to fix things, and that's the type of things we do already, stream bank erosion,
pollution abatement projects on farms. We also, through our soil and water conservation districts, we have 11 technical service providing areas across the state. There's two within my area here. There's six counties down in our area that form one of them, called Impact 6, and then there's five counties up here, also part of another one. And they've been funded through Bowser and the state legislature, and currently we're about 25 or higher percent shortfall. We have to provide at least 25% of our own funding to stay in existence. And we're the ones that are out there providing projects for the landowners and the farmers out there, doing engineering, technical assistance. And this bill would provide money to hopefully maybe make up some of that shortfall and to help the districts provide the services that are desperately needed out there. And I guess, like I said, speaking on behalf of the bill, we can argue over little things and what needs to be done. I think when it gets down to the end, just my personal feeling is I really hated last year when everybody at both sides of the aisle saying, yes, this is really needed, yes, this is really needed, and then it dies because we can't decide how to fund it. You know, talking a good talk and saying something's needed, and then it'll die because we can't find funding, just doesn't cut it out here in the grassroots. We got to figure out how to do it. We just can't say we need it, but we can't figure out how to fund it. You know, that's the thing. We got to figure out how to fund it. And that shouldn't have been the job of the G16. That's the job of the legislature and the governor's office. And I guess that's my main thing is just, I think 99% of people think it's needed. We just got to get it funded.
Okay, any questions from the members? Okay, thank you very much. You did go out the horn there. Who is next? Who would like Dennis? The county commissioners, Fink, and Nelson would like to come before you.
Chair, there could be a wrestling match here, but we'll get to that microphone.
Before you start, Commissioner Pinkett Nelson, I'd like to ask you the same question that I asked the other testifiers. How were the counties, and I know that you were the former chair of the Association of Minnesota Counties, of all 87 counties, of their representative groups, so I know you know about these things. How were your interests, St. Louis County's interests, represented, and how did you present those to the G16?
Thank you, Mr.
You're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Dennis Fink, St. Louis County Commissioner, District 1, and former president of the AMC. To that specific question, and I will leave my chair with the beginning remarks from us. The Association of Minnesota Counties did have a seat on G16. That seat remained a membership seat until the counties objected to the funding mechanism. The committee then became a G15 as we were not invited, as we were looking at what we would think would be a better funding mechanism or some alternative. As you all know, the G16 is no longer the G16. It's now the G18 or perhaps 19 as of this week. Two additional members were added and we were invited back to the table. And so we did have some input, and obviously some of our input has been addressed in the bill, in the current language that you're looking at between the current bill and what is on the table today.
So I would take from that, except for the policy matter of the funding, prior to now, when you've been reinvited back, that your other policy information was given and accepted to the G16 or to the group.
We will talk about two issues tonight that we think needs to be in the bill that perhaps is not in the bill at this particular moment. One of those makes reference, in fact, to the committee of 14 that is put forth right now. The line that represents counties says a single representative of a county organization or an organization representing the counties. We actually think that language, since only one organization, there are a number of organizations that represent counties, but only one that represents all 87. We actually think that letter, that language should be specific. We also think because there are two specific areas of the a metropolitan area as well as a rural area, that language should be two, so that we could have representatives from both the rural and the metro area.
All right, Chairman Nelson, new county board chair, smiling on his face and ready to tackle that job. Welcome.
Thank you, Representative Dill. Mr. Chair, committee members, on behalf of the 449 county commissioners throughout the state of Minnesota, I really look at that representative there. I look on page 11 of the bill, where it stipulates one member representing an organization of county governments. When you look at the wide-reaching effects of this bill, and knowing that county commissioners not only represent rural constituents but also some of the smaller municipalities within their districts, I think it's really important that we see two county commission members. And I also think that it's very important, given the other makeup of that committee, that those two commissioners come from the Association of Minnesota Counties, so that you see some greater Minnesota representation on there as well. My remarks before I allow Commissioner Fink to get into the meat of some of the things that are concerning us in this process. Just hearing this $20 million figure thrown out there, and hearing the remarks from individuals saying that this is not about creating more bureaucracy. I know there's more than 10,000 lakes in Minnesota, 12,000 or 13,000. And you know, I haven't counted the rivers or their tributaries, but you know, let's just take a wild guess at it. Let's say it's another 10 or 13,000.
Nelson, do you have any answer to that? It's approximately 91,000 miles that we go between here.
But given that, I still see the $20 million of assessment. If we are truly interested in getting things, projects on the ground, addressing those needs that currently exist, I think it would be important to look at dropping that initial amount of dollars down and getting some of those much-needed projects on the ground. I look at towns and townships and subordinate sewer districts just within my district that certainly could address a lot of concerns out on the ground in the communities, and that is the place where the dollars should go to have that initial impact. $20 million of study, to me, is building a bureaucracy, and then the question is, who feeds that bureaucracy once you've built it?
Could we get to an explanation of the $20 million? Because it's certainly not a study. And it's not. Mr. Nelson, could you give us a breakdown of that so we have a better idea? I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'm sure you need that information.
Mr. Chairman and members of the county board, thank you for putting this in here. Just to clarify, if we look at it, the draft numbers, the G16 has been for year 5 of this proposal, which would be fiscal year 10, 2010, there would be, let me go to the breakdown in the back here, a total of, for MPCA, $7 million for the assessment and monitoring work. Remember, this is not just PCA stuff, because the resources for citizen monitors and a number of other people who are engaged in collecting data, including federal DNR and USGS and university graduate programs. The total for PMDL development, which is the all-important piece we've been hearing about tonight, to the agency would be $5.9 million. So we're talking about $12 to $13 million to MPCA in the fifth year of implementation,
I think the full ramp-up for us would be in year 6 or 7. I just don't happen to have those numbers with me tonight. Of that, the agency, at the end of this, at this stage, would be having a total of 121 FECs to do this work. The bulk of the work will be done through contracts to local units and other distributed work. The third-party TMDLs, which has been a concern to some, is a very important part of this because the estimates I saw going into the development of this after the auditor asked us to look at what it would cost to implement the Clean Water Act in Minnesota, and after the legislature asked us to report back, the initial estimates I saw were that it would take an additional 80 to 100 state staff to run this program. The budget and the proposal for you was all about leveraging local resources rather than building state resources. So I hope that's helping answer some of the questions.
Representative Ogden?
Mr. Chair, so instead of adding 100 plus staff or whatever, you are adding 21, and then you're relying upon existing agencies and existing local governments to provide for those, and that's where some of the funding is going to support them?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. And then on behalf of the other agencies, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, I think they would have an additional 6 or 7 FTEs by the time this is fully up and running. Recognize that currently there are federal dollars that go unmatched and unleveraged because we don't have technical assistance. So there are resources for local SWCB and watershed district and county technical assistance as well. So this is very much about leveraging out and not leveraging at the state level.
Mr. Chair, the 21 or 27 you're talking about, are those individuals to have a study, or are those individuals to actually provide assistance to local governments and people at the grassroots level?
A combination thereof. Some of those folks will actually be doing some of the study work and some of the monitoring. A number of them will also be doing work leveraging other resources as well. As you can imagine, if one is going to have voluntary or third-party TMDLs, voluntary data collection or third-party TMDLs, we need to maintain and manage that system so that it meets the quality that is required by the Clean Water Act and the federal government to move this forward. So it does take some capacity simply to do that, but we have been kept very lean.
Representative, to that point, Mr. Chair, and Representative Osley, good question. I'm glad you brought him up. I think the commissioner is right. And I mean, I was adding, I got 37 plus 5.9 to 13. Now we talk about some of the soil and water districts and local governments and what they're required. I think we quickly do get to 20 million that's going to assessment, study, TMDLs, and others. I think what the commissioner is saying is, you know, we could ask Terry Coleman sitting back here, take that 20 million and how much debt service like PM water infrastructure funding or other things that can immediately hit the ground, help our cities and others get going on this and actually start cleaning up our waters rather than dedicating 20 million for 5 years to study this. We know we got a problem today, so I think that's what the AMC is getting at here, and I think it is something that we need to kind of wrestle through and see, you know, what's the best utilization of these resources out of the chute. Again, I think as a general public, they want to see something bought. They want to see something working. They want to see something getting down and going, and I think that's one of the things we struggle with is how much in studying and how much in actual practice on the ground.
And that's why I wanted those figures brought out, because I thought Mr. was making very good points, and I think it should be something we should try to follow up on in more detail. So, appreciate that.
Representative Peterson.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Bill. Mr. Pence, could you make a rewind to the year, say, 2002? Or earlier or later, however you want to focus in on. Speaking from the MPCA's standpoint, FTE is about 21, you mentioned, under this. Okay. The short question is, where were we for staffing levels during the 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005 budgets compared to what this is proposing to, I guess my assumption is, get us back to where we used to be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, first of all, the premise that we used to be somewhere is not correct. Our city has never had, the city of Minnesota has never had the full suite of resources to complete the assessment and monitoring of Minnesota service waters every decade.
Right, I'm aware.
We more than have the other resources to develop TMD levels, especially in a way that
right.
Can you
comment on the staff level that you used to have, and then the last couple of budgets went through, and the staff you might have now?
Mr. Chairman, the agency over the last 6 to 8 years has been downsized from, we have been downsized to somewhere around 730 FTEs from, I believe, a one time up around 870 or closer to 900. So that's happened over a period of years with respect to the fiscal situation and issues related to the agency. The other in more recent years, other agencies have taken cuts. The PCA, I think, was actually the first environmental agency to go through this week. We took our reductions earlier.
And that was in the late 90s?
That was in the late 90s. So, yes.
Okay. Just asking.
Any other questions? Anything?
Again, thank you for that explanation. I still think that the representatives on this commission need to assess that as much as possible. The other concern that I have is the usurping of authority of local government bodies, which in fact is something that if we are going to enter into agreements with third parties to exercise or execute these TMDLs, it's one thing to hire someone to do that study. It is totally another if you are going to take that authority away from town boards, township boards, city councils. These are the locally elected officials that are going to know best what the people of their communities want and need within their communities. And if we are going to turn that over, early on when I was on the county board, I was told by the commissioner to my right here, never to say never. And I heard one environmental police representative here tonight use the never word 3 times. And that concerns me because if we're going to put this in the hands of outside authorities, outside groups, then we are not recognizing the local government entities that we need to recognize. I think that third-party language needs to be stiffened up a lot in order for this to be exercised effectively within our communities. Not every action that is taken down in St. Paul is totally understood when it leaves St. Paul. One of the things that we are asked to do is to enact this where the rubber meets the road in county government, many times within our planning and zoning authorities, and that particular piece of it is going to be very concerning as any development or any business, whether it's small or large, comes before us. We need to have local government control of that. Thank you very much for coming to my district, as well as Representative Rukavina's district, to hear our thoughts.
Thank you.
First off, you should know that the county and the counties are not against having some kind of a water plan and system in place. Remember, you've already required us in the past to put together ordinances on septic systems and to have water plans as part of our overall planning process for the future and today, for that matter. And I want to respond to the hit the ground running piece that was brought up. You know, one of the initial things that we talked about 2 years ago when this Legacy Act first came out was the counties were looking at how they handle their septic systems within their septic system ordinances. In Louis County, we have a point of purchase policy within the new ordinance that based on the 1996 revision of the 80s. One of the things that we've discovered is that is not universal across the state. If it were universal, you would have a gradual, continual cleaning up of one of the areas that's highlighted in the as a problem in the Clean Water Quality Act. What St. Louis County is finding that after 4 years of this being in our ordinance, we've already looked at and inspected and have paperwork on over 4,000 septic systems as a result of them changing hands, which gives us the opportunity to go in and look and say, all right, is there any problems? Is it failing by definition? Is it failing because of some health challenge? And we are moving in a direction without utilizing a bunch of new resources within the current day-to-day operations to achieve what is in fact intended to be achieved as a component of the Legacy Act. So we appreciate that. And we want to point that out as an opportunity for legislature to consider the possibility as AMC is putting together a document that would include that along with a couple other recommendations. In addition to that, Mr. Johnson, you were absolutely right when you talked about the big round area over there. What does that mean in terms of the state? From our perspective, we actually see that as a problem rather than a solution. We see that as a problem because of the significant size. What we believe should happen in this particular document is somehow prioritize uniquely different than what the situation says. On page 6 and 7, there is a priority list that says that indicates that there is in fact some priority to actually doing the studies, the PMDLs, and the plan that comes as a result of that. But from where we sit, we're saying that Mr. Osmond made a good point earlier on tonight when you said we should be looking at this watershed by watershed by watershed to accomplish our goals. What we're concerned about from a county's perspective is as we look at this document, the interpretation for implementation is likely to be uniquely different than what the intention of the committee is. And so that when we identify a body of water that may need some attention, if it shows up in one watershed, should we in fact assume that across the state everybody can find a body of water in their watershed, and that we will then be impacting the entire state right now so that no additional permitting can take place? We would argue that would be bad legislation. What we would encourage you to do is look at that portion that talks about priorities and not relate it just to the fact that there are, in fact, some identified waters which may be more, should need more attention than the others, but to identify the watershed and say, if you're in that watershed now, until the plans for that watershed are complete, we don't want you to move on to the next watershed. Presenting a process by which we can move forward systematically. Otherwise, you shut down the state. And I don't know that we want to do that. Now, I've had several commissioners from our district, and our district is a 7-county district running up the Arrowhead from starting at Pine County, come to our last AMC district meeting and say, we can't put our water purification system in because we are part of the brown blob. Their permits were turned down. Had they been in their own watershed, that would not have been the case. And this is not because their particular water facilities actually have a TMDL problem. It's because somebody else within that blob has the problem. So we're real concerned about how that language is written so that, in fact, priority means not only most impaired, but also on a unit-by-unit basis.
Representative Bosley? To that point, are you referring to some items in the books I'm looking at that have the priorities and they're not referring to the same thing that you're talking about? Well, I believe the item that you're referencing is actually in the Federal Clean Water Act, and it's not under our control.
We
what I'm suggesting...
We're miscommunicating anything.
Actually, there's an interpretation of what the Clean Water Act actually says as to how you have to go about doing each of these things. As you know, the court said, hey, listen, you spotted it, you're dead. We don't think that that's necessarily what the plan said. We'd like to see this bill act as that document that overrides and says, this is our plan to manage the entire state. Please accept this as our process to cleaning up the water as it relates to the Water Act, and then within it have a systematic approach. In other words, what I'm saying is, if we look at this and assume that the entire state is open and that the Clean Water Act is the driving force, essentially what it says is, find a TMDL, write a plan. If you identify this particular piece of legislation as a response to the entire Clean Water Act, and then said within this plan, that then determines how we're going to go about cleaning up each significant portion, I believe that you would solve the legal problem that you have at this particular moment.
Ken, sure, it's an interesting point. We'll have some legal people take a look at that. I think that the concern that we have is that we want to be able to get the TMDL in place, because that's actually at the tool in the toolbox. You don't have to implement it. You got years to actually implement it, and it will go in phases depending upon whatever the evaluations were at the time they took a look at it. And so it does provide for a lot of flexibility. But if you're talking about an entire brown area, that what we have to have is a TMDL to cover the entire area, that will help, if that can be done, that will help for parts of it. It won't give an impact on those smaller watersheds as they have impairments. And so if you have, like if we do an entire water TMDL for the Lake Tappan area, or Lake Mississippi Road, watershed. But then inside that watershed, you have another small one that has a lake that is impaired before it goes into the Mississippi. Then we wouldn't be addressing that. And I don't know if the larger one would be enough to be able to take care of it, or they would end up paying people separately. Just kind of all over the place.
To be honest with you, hanging separately is a lot better than hanging together when you can't get a permit.
Well, I think you're not going to get a permit anyway, but that's the thing. We'll check that.
Mr. Johnson has something to add. He'd like to add into this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota City again. And actually, the general comments that the commissioners are making and both commissioners have been making are completely consistent with what we have been discussing all along. I actually don't believe they are at odds with what is in this bill right now. What the bill specifically focuses on is keeping the process of developing these studies at the local level. And that is over and over again required of the agency as part of their process in doing these TMDLs. The studies that are done to determine how much of the pollution goes where and who needs to reduce how much are already being done. And they're not being done primarily by the state. They're being done by watershed districts, by soil and water the soil and water districts in the cities. That's who works with this stuff every day. And that's who we really want developing these from the ground up. That's what's written into this bill right now. And that's who the third parties are in the third party TMDL. So they're already being done. That's who's winning. The question about focusing priorities, maybe I'm not entirely understanding the argument, but what this bill says is we should look at each watershed, we should identify as many of the problems in that watershed at one time as we can, and we should get them addressed. And it is going to move around the state. Now, right now, the big focus, obviously, because it's a big brown blob, is Lake Tappan. But hopefully, by 2009, that TMDL is supposed to be done and approved by the federal government. And we'll be able to look at Lake Zumbro, or Lake Chetak, or a section of a river somewhere that needs help. And we will keep moving that target as the priority. So the Pollution Control Agency website actually has a calendar of where these PMDLs are going to be done for the next 13 years. You can look at it to see when your community expects to see them. We already have cities contacting us, looking at that calendar and saying, you mean they're not going to try and figure out what we have to do until 2012? We can't wait that long. We need a new wastewater plant several years before that. What can we do? The answer is, you right now can go out and start working on this PMDL with your other local governments in the area earlier than that. But you have to go through the contracting and the approval of the Pollution Control Agency to get that done. What Representative Osmond has put into the bill are requirements for what a person has to do to qualify for that, including conflict of interest requirements. So, for instance, if you're involved in litigation against the state or against the local government in the area, you can't be involved in draft in being the scientific advisor for the PMDL. That's just all there is to it. I would go back quickly to the idea of putting money into it on the ground work. That is exactly what we have been arguing for. The bill, as you currently see it, the $40 million, the breakdown is almost 90% of that $40 million goes into protection and restoration work. $17 million goes directly to cities for on-the-ground, currently needed, fundable projects. And the rest goes out to counties for soil, or for, I think we've got $1.5 million in there in the first year for counties to help with their local comprehensive water plans. A number of those sorts of programs that we agree are very effective and we should be putting more resources into them. That's what the bill currently is set up to do.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner?
Just to address one point that was just made, my concern in the language that I see in this bill does not designate local government entities as third-party TMDL development. If you look under subdivision 5, line 7 through 15, on page 10, if you read that, that clearly, in my opinion, is an effort to usurp the authority of local government. And that is the concern that I have. That specific language allows for private nonprofit entities to set forth the terms and conditions. And just, I'm not going to bore you by reading that. I know you've probably read it 15 times already. But those lines, that's 7 through 14 through 15, that is of particular concern to me. As I see these being developed throughout greater Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, because that's certainly not our agreement. As I'm hearing what you're saying, what you want to have happen is what we want to have in the bill also. But we have, in order to try and make certain that somebody's not taking away somebody else's authority, as we make, first of all, you're complying with federal law, and then secondly, it has to all comes underneath the only authority of the Minnesota Fish and Birds. Nobody can jump in and do anything unless it's with the MPCA. And so that's the reason why I mentioned earlier that I had included, or intend to include, underneath the goals and objectives of what they should be trying to accomplish, the sections or the provisions that we have in here with regard to 114 D.45, which is actually
Pacer.
It starts on section 10, excuse me, but let me back up for just a second here. John, is there any
comment?
Section 6. Section 6 is what we want to include. So we make sure that everybody stays on the same page. But we'll continue to look at that and make sure that's taken care of.
Okay, Commissioner Fink?
Finally, we just want to thank you for coming to Northern Minnesota and talking and giving us an opportunity to talk to you. Certainly, one of those of you who are local know that I'm from Duluth, but unfortunately tomorrow we have a board meeting in Virginia. So it's unlikely we would have an opportunity to come and talk to you at the, in the morning, so we really appreciate you having this evening meeting. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Thank you. Excellent information. Okay, the next person who is, would like to testify before the committee for their testimony? Yes. Mr. Shell. Still whining. We turn down one more.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good evening. My name is John Shell. I'm with the Arrowhead Regional Development Commission in Duluth. We are a seven-county regional planning organization, and it's good to see you, Chairman. I had four specific comments. I just wanted, based on our discussions with our commission, which are really the members of local units of government in northeastern Minnesota that owns our organization, we are simply a planning extension of municipalities, townships, and counties in northeastern Minnesota, that there was a good deal of concern expressed consistent with the previous testimony regarding the comment the Pollution Control Agency must make reasonable efforts to notify cities, counties, townships, etc., affected by a TMDL. Again, I think it's been covered well. We would like to be a part of that process of TMDL development. The three other points I can go through briefly. First is the Clean Water Council. Again, we, just as a comment, would suggest that the structure of the Clean Water Council perhaps should be structured around watersheds themselves rather than the organizations and agencies that are supporting and concerned with this legislation. Clearly, Minnesota has to move towards structures which reflect our watershed concerns, and major watersheds should be represented, we believe, on the Clean Water Council. The second point is the small community wastewater loans and grants. One of the issues is really in the language, which seems to suggest that communities stop at their political boundary. We are now working on the Lake Superior shoreline and also with a group in Itasca County called the Central Itasca County Coordinating Board, which is a joint powers group of townships and cities and the county looking at wastewater issues. Certainly their concerns, their work on both the municipal system, group treatment systems, cluster facilities, as well as individual septic tank issues in that area, would suggest that their ability to work together will really provide a more effective approach to wastewater treatment in the context of TMDLs than individual grants to individual municipalities. So in that process, if you could provide incentives for multi-jurisdictional planning, development, and enforcement around these wastewater issues, it would be very, very helpful. We know that for many of our communities in northeastern Minnesota, we have, indeed, as the Mosquito Control District does, suburban growth around our urban areas of northeastern Minnesota. Indeed, in Moose Lake, for example, the assessed valuation of the surrounding townships now is significantly greater than the community of Moose Lake itself. And yet Moose Lake itself is supposed to provide services that are complementary to the citizens who have chosen to move outside of the city rather than in it itself. Again, whether it's wastewater treatment or library services, incentives to provide local units of government to work together around a central problem, I think, will more effectively address the issue, and would hope that even in, perhaps in the rules and regulations associated with small community wastewater loans, that there would be those incentives for multi-jurisdictional development. And then finally, you know, we have in northern Minnesota basin planning efforts directed by the Pollution Control Agency going on in the Rainy and St. Louis Rivers. Are those processes going to be abandoned, or will they be the context under which the TMDLs will develop? The Lake Superior and St. Louis County and Rainy River planning process has been going on, I suspect, for 6 to 8 years now, and it would be perhaps in the context of those planning efforts that these TMDLs could most effectively be developed. Now, those are the end of my comments, and again, I appreciate the opportunity to speak here tonight.
Any questions from the members, Mr. Shelman? Thank you.
Thank you.
And the next person would like to testify, please come forward. Anyone else?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rodriguez.
Chair, if there are no other people that are coming forward to testify, I would be remiss if I didn't, because I have a number of constituents here in the audience today. If I didn't thank Chair Osmond for the help that he gave us last session, Mr. Chair, in a project that's going to be right down the road here, and that is the Laurentian Biomass Project. And Chair Osmond, I'm very appreciative of what you did to help us pass through that along. The bonds have been led for the project. The actual woodyard and storage of the chips is going to be right here in the Mount Manor community. And then there'll be trucks between here and Hibbing in Virginia. But you played a very important role in that, and I appreciate your help on that. You didn't give us any money, but you gave us a lot of language we needed. I, you know, and with that comment, I hope to get some money with it.
Well, I'd also like to add, and not necessarily in this last session, but since I've been in the legislature, both the Representative Hackbar chairs the Environmental Policy Committee, and of course, Representative Osmond chairs the Environmental and Finance Committee, and the Masaba Nugget Project, which you know is now at the beginning at this new beginning, nearly ready for groundbreaking, would not have really been possible had not they helped these two individuals helped us clear many roadblocks, not only with the PCA, but through our committees and also at the governor's office. So what I'm trying to say is, of course, thank you to these folks. But this has really been, of all the hearings that we've held so far, this has been a really excellent communication between at the other hearings, interestingly enough, in Maple Lake, in Annandale, and in Lesueur, it was more bureaucrats who were talking, and there was more information than we already knew. And I think I felt tonight that I learned quite a bit of information that that is good for us, that we'll be taking back. And I've been watching Representative Osmond scribbling notes feverishly, and I'm certain that many of these things will be looked at and taken into consideration. And it's exactly this type of meeting that helps to formulate the good parts of these bills that do eventually become law as a rule. So, really, that's good. A Representative Sturgis should like to. Are you thanking me?
I'm actually going to right away. Yeah, you did a great job.
Oh, thank you. I just want to make sure you're thanking me. I wasn't all about
it. And Charlesman, I want to thank you for coming up here and addressing this with the constituents. I do want to say that Senator Tomasoni wished he could be here today, but he had to be in St. Paul, and we were reminded that he had to say that. I know we don't like to give our senators all the credit all the time, but he did want to be here, but he had to be down in St. Paul. One thing, and I don't want to prolong the meeting, that I would like to see, because this has been very informative, and that's I'm glad, Chair, that you and your staff invited two legislators from up here who don't sit on the committee to listen in, because this is more than I've learned about this. I've had some constituents give me information, which has been helpful, but this is the most I've learned about this issue, because I haven't seen it come through any committees I sit on yet, as we sit in silos in St. Paul sometimes and don't get all this information. But something that really struck me today was about mercury. And just the simple fact that 90% of our mercury pollution comes from outside Minnesota. And it's frustrating because we don't know who's responsible for the air. I mean, we can draw in maps, you know, here's pollution here and there, but who's really responsible for the air? A lot of this mercury has got to be coming from the Dakotas, from Canada. It's coming from the West. And if it's 90% and we're talking about polluters paying or who's responsible for what and how much money we're sticking in, it really goes back to the fact that the feds have to pay a role because we can't charge Dakota for the pollution they put in Minnesota. It's the responsibility of the governmental entity that's bigger than us that is responsible for our whole body. So I'd really like to see, not now, don't prolong this, put some information on that if you have any, where this 90% is coming from. Because that's a huge number. But thanks again for coming.
Representative Osmond, thank you, Representative.
You're very welcome, and Representative, I want you to know that I think the Food Control Agency has been quite creative in how they're trying to deal with this mercury issue. And they have put together a TMDL for the entire state of Minnesota that on this particular one, because it's 90% of it is coming from outside of our state, and they're trying to get the federal government, if they can get the approved here at the state,
send that TMDL to the EPA, and if they actually approve that TMDL, it will show that the total maximum daily load of that mercury is coming from other locations, and it should put the federal government pressure on those other locations, and we would be one of the motivators of getting that to happen. So they're trying to use the federal process and legislation to actually force the federal government to start to try and do something about our issue.
All right, any further questions or people would like to address the committee or thoughts, ideas? Please, this is your time to talk about this. Of course, you are welcome to contact any of us directly on this issue. We are easily found on the internet, house.mn. You can get us easy through the internet. That's really simple. Or look us up in the phone book. We're all there.
And I have represented Bill's new private phone number right here.
Let me tell you something. Look at me, and I'll give you the last four numbers. 7, the devil, 666. Thank you very much.